Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Hello, world. This is Pamela Elaine Lockridge coming to you from Louisiana, starting the Stop Child Abuse Now radio show sponsored by the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. This is scan number 2608. My co-host tonight is Penelope, and she's going to read the mission statement, which is very important for NASCA. Penelope?
Thank you so much, Pamela. And NASCA is all about child abuse, trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA: to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. And two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Thank you, Pamela.
Thank you, Penelope. I wanted to give out the phone number to call in. The number to call in tonight and be a panelist and interact with our guests and support her is 646-595-2118. 646-595-2118. And we are on Eastern, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Also, I want to let you know that if you want to come on NASCA and tell your story and be a special guest, we do that on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And you can call, look at the front page of NASCA, NAASCA.org, and it'll give you my information, bellsouth.net, to reach out to me, and I can book you into a show. But without further ado, tonight we have a special guest, and I'm going to unmute her mic. Her name is Francine Ann Arumu, and I do, Umaru. I just butchered that name, and I'm so sorry, Francine.
No, it's
she's
fine.
From Crofton. She's from Crofton, Maryland. She's also known as Sister Fran. I love that. She's born in Brooklyn, New York, and raised in Englewood, New Jersey. She is very proud of her Jamaican heritage, as are we. And I'm going to let her start and tell us about her family when she started growing up. So, Francine, if you don't mind starting in chronological order and telling us a little bit about your story. As you were starting up in your tender years,
okay,
in your
sure.
developmental age,
sure. So, unfortunately, I was sexually physically and emotionally abused by my birth father. It started when I was about the ages of 12 and 13 years old. My mother was complicit in the abuse. She still married to him till today, and she didn't do anything to protect me or my siblings. I will often say that she was part of the grooming process because she knew that he was a pedophile. He's a registered sex offender, and she worked night shifts, and she would be away from home on the weekends. And the way the house was set up.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
I just want you to go back into, you know, like when you were born, you know, how many siblings, how the family was, because it's like, you know, we're skipping to age 12 and we're leaving out a lot of your story before age 12.
Okay.
So can you kind of, fill us in on your, you know, briefly on getting to that age and how it was. And you lived in Jamaica. Did you live in Jamaica at that time?
No. No, my parents were both from Jamaica, and I was born in Brooklyn, New York. I have a twin brother, and I have two younger sisters and an older sister. So we moved around a lot, unfortunately. But Englewood, New Jersey was where I spent most of my childhood years, and that's where the abuse occurred, in Englewood, New Jersey. But prior to that, we moved a lot because my father sexually abused my sister. And my mom moved from Philly where it had happened. That's, I believe it initially happened in Irvington, New Jersey. And then he was arrested for the sexual abuse that happened to my sister. And then my mom moved to Philly. And then he was released from jail, and then he reoffended her. And then we moved to Englewood, New Jersey, with his family. And, of course, he was living there. So that's how we ended up there and how it all started with me. So he has, like, this pattern of abuse, sexual abuse, and she knows this. He never got the help that he was supposed to get. I don't even think my sister got the help that she needed at the time, because from what I understand, she had to change her story at some point just so that he didn't have to do the time that he was supposed to do. But my sister, she stayed in Philly. She went to law school, and we were in Englewood, New Jersey at the time when it started with me.
Okay. So we have panelists that come on and ask questions or make comments. And I'm going to ask Penelope, who is my co-host, to kind of help us to kind of, I don't want to say dig into, but, you know, kind of understand the era between your birth and then when you started being abused. And we don't really expect you to tell anybody else's story, so we're not really looking for that.
Yeah,
either. Penelope.
Exactly. I don't want to go into too much details when it was regarding my siblings' abuse. I just want to, you know, focus on my abuse.
Okay.
Yeah.
Penelope.
Yeah, and I totally understand that, right? Because I mean, sometimes in families, as we know, the abuse is not singular in terms of the children, but I understand that we want to stick to our own story, and you know, we don't want to disclose what we believe we observe with our siblings. So I you know, Francine, I respect that completely, and I know when Pamela spoke with you as well before you came on the show, when you were setting up the date, it helps the listeners, whether we're on the panel or they're streaming in and listening to it online, to get this a little bit of chronology from your earliest years, just to help put the pieces together of your life. It just helps to follow. So it just helps all of us. But what I wanted to say is, if there's anything that's making you uncomfortable about your own story, you don't want to go someplace, that's perfectly fine. And I know Pamela already discussed that with you, but as I now ask you a couple questions, if there's something that you don't feel comfortable answering, don't, right? It's your show. You know, there's a couple things that struck me. So I'm thinking, okay, well, your mother married a known pedophile. Is that what I heard correctly?
Yes. Well, when she married him, I don't think she knew that he was a pedophile. But
okay. She
knew eventually when it had happened to one of my siblings. And she didn't do anything to protect my sibling, to protect my sibling, or even got her the help that she needed to heal from that. And so he did do some time. He did do some time for it. But every time he's like, he was released, she'll take him back. And it's like, it's just a pattern. It's just, you know this about him. So why not just be done with him, divorce him, you know, just be there for your kids, be there for your daughters, be there for your, you know.
Well,
she's
yeah,
still
I mean, as a parent. Right.
She's still married.
She's still married to him today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a parent myself, you know, I mean, obviously we're all different, but I mean, if something happened like that to my child in my home by my husband, I would be like a mother bear, right? It's hard.
Yeah.
You know, not only is there abuse going on in the home, but it's really hard when the other parent isn't being protective. It feels like it's a double betrayal, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
It's
like
how your own mother. Exactly.
Yes,
exactly. How your own.
Once the child discloses the abuse, whether they disclose or you find out, I mean, the first thing is for you to not only believe the child, but to make sure that, you know, the child gets the healing and the support that they need to get through that part. And when they don't get that, I mean, that's just added trauma. You know,
it's
like, how do you learn to even trust again during your childhood years, after that trust between you and your parents has been broken. And that's where you learn mm-hmm. to trust is by your parents. So that was just, mm-hmm. to me, I just feel like that's just added trauma when, one, just the victims not believe, and two, they're not getting the help that they need to go to, you know, heal.
Exactly. And my other question, if Pamela will allow me, was as I'm listening to this, is so your sister, her abuse, you know, came before yours, and before that abuse was disclosed and known by your mother, or by your family, or by the siblings. As a younger sibling, as a younger sister, did you suspect? Did you have a sense of what was going on in the home at all before this was brought up and out into the open?
I've heard rumors. Like when we moved to New Jersey, didn't see my sister because I know there was times that, you know, she ran away from home. But I just know that when we had moved to Englewood, you know, I didn't see much of her. And anytime I would bring her name up, you know, in front of my parents, they would like get defensive and, you know, they would just say really bad things about her, which I knew that wasn't the case with her, but I just knew that something wasn't right and that they were hiding something. Mm. Every time I would try to talk to her on the phone, like, they would have me on speaker. They would monitor my time on the phone with her. But that's how I knew that they were hiding something. And I've heard rumors about what had happened, so I just never got the full story. But my sister always made it a priority to, like, check in with me and my other siblings to make sure we're okay. That's one thing that she always done, because she was, you know, in college. But yeah, that's when I knew that something was definitely up, and I just didn't get the full story until I've gotten older. But the thing about it is, when the sexual abuse started, my father disclosed that what he did to her, and he said it in a way as though he was like prepping me for it, you know. So it's not like I got his side; I just didn't get the whole story. As I got older, I finally got the story to my sister, but he said it in a way as though it's like, that's okay. Like, I did it to her, so I can do it to you. Like, there's no big deal.
Right, and that's the grooming. That's the
grooming, exactly.
Yeah, and also, you know, they set these mindsets within us where we want to believe our parents, right? I mean, these are our, you know, adult role models in the home, and they set a lot of different modeling, right? Their behavior and their comments model our thoughts. And, you know, I've heard so many other stories as well, where, you know, you grow up and you think this is just what happens, right? Because it's what you know is what, you know, presented to you is the way that things are. It sounds like your father certainly did that. So it sounds like you were already growing up in a home where there was secrecy and distrust.
Yeah.
So thank you for sharing that with me. And you're doing an amazing job of telling your story, by the way. And I'm very, very inspired by you. I think it takes a lot of courage. So you just keep on keeping on, and I'll let someone else chime in now. But thank you for answering my questions.
No problem.
Thank you, Penelope. So she really is getting into your story and making it come out more, you know, filling in the blanks, really. My question, if you don't mind, Francine, is you said your mother knew that he was a pedophile. Did she know before she married him even?
I don't think she knew before she married him. There was a lot of, I know for a fact there were like red flags before she married him about probably his like controlling ways and, you know, his characteristics. And I'm pretty sure there were red flags there, but she just never paid attention to it. One thing I do know about my mother is that she has very, very low self-esteem. And he is almost as though he couldn't do any wrong. And because of that, he wasn't held accountable for any of his wrongdoings. He just continuously kept doing it. And, you know, like I said, it wasn't just the sexual abuse. It was the physical abuse. It was the emotional abuse. It was just a very, very toxic environment. And it was almost as though, like, she was just okay with that. Like, she didn't really have much say in anything. All she did really was just work. That was just all she did, was bring home the check. But,
so do you think your dad had some forms of narcissism, like, you know, controlling and, you know, trying to control her with fear?
To be quite honest, fear. I think my mother is more of a narcissist than he is. I wouldn't consider him a narcissist. I know for a fact that he has, like, a mental illness, obviously. He's sick because this is something that he's done, and he's doing it again. And it's just a repeated cycle. My mother,
right.
The thing with my father, he displayed emotion, you know, even though he's sick and he did it in inappropriate ways, he still showed affection. My mother didn't display any of that. She never said, I love you. She never, you know, laughed and joked with us. Like, I don't have any fond memories of anything good or anything positive to say with her growing up. All I remember is just seeing her walk out the door. You know, she barely cooked. When she did, it wasn't like the type of meals that, you know how mothers will, like, prepare meals for the family with love and warmth. And, you know, she'll teach you a couple of recipes and things of that sort, but she was just cold natured to me. And one of the things I've noticed about her growing up is that if you call him out on what he has done or is on his bad side, if you're on his bad side, it's like you're the enemy. It's like the black sheep or the scapegoat or one in the family. So I was like that child. I've made straight A's. I've made the honor roll, you know, but I was just always considered like this problematic child, like, because I was outspoken for one. And it's like my mother would like create this reputation of me that I was fast and that I was just always had an attitude. And I'm the child who wants to break up the family, basically, you know. So that was like that,
you know,
the guilt that I would have to go through as a child.
Yeah.
That I'm the one that's breaking up the family.
You know what it sounds like? She was almost jealous of you, in competition with you.
the competition, I definitely agree.
So it also says here in your bio, it also says in your bio that not only were you sexually abused by him, but you were physically, verbally, and emotionally abused.
Yep.
How did he physically abuse you?
So we were all, so even though I was sexually abused at the time, in the moment when I was in that household, we were all physically abused. You know, with me, because I was outspoken, he would, like, slap me in my face, punch me in my face. There's time that he would get, I remember one time I came home from school late, and he got a wooden brush, and he beat me with it. There was a time that I guess the school may have called, because, you know, when I was going through the abuse, I would ask that in school. I mean, that was just what happened. And when the school would call and tell him, you know, she either skipped class or she's just not behaving herself. I remember one time he came into my room, picked up, like, a boot heel, one of my boot heels in my room, and it had, like, a really, really, really thick heel, like, very, very wide. And he kind of, he pushed my head down into the bed, my head, and he got the boot heel and hammered the side of my head, hammered. You know when you hammer something? Like, hammered me in the side of my head. And the side of my face, you know, it got swollen. It was swollen. I couldn't go to school the next day. It was swollen. And I remember clearly, like, screaming when that happened. And I remember after it happened, my grandfather, because my grandfather lived with us too. My grandparents lived with us. They lived upstairs. I remember my grandfather coming down, and, like, he came down because I know he heard me scream, but he came almost to, like, check on me to make sure I was okay. And then when he knew that I was okay, he didn't say anything. He just looked and then went back upstairs. But
was
like,
that your mother?
No, that is my father's father. And even with my siblings, like, I remember with my brother, my twin brother, getting beaten with, like, a wrench. In his joints. He got a wrench and beat my brother in his joints, and my brother couldn't walk up the stairs, and I had to help him up. You know,
ooh.
Like, he was very, very abusive. I remember one time he had to come to my school. One of the teachers had called him, and when they told him, you know, I don't remember what the issue was, but he slapped me in front of the teacher, like, slapped me in the face in front of the teacher. And I always wonder why the teacher never, you know, asked about, you know, how did it go that day? Are you okay? It's almost as though they felt like it was necessary. But, you know, back then, no one really, really, it's almost as though they just turned the other cheek with, in situations like that. But my father, to tell you a little bit more about, in depth, about how, the thing is, he had too much access to us. That was the problem. Like, he didn't want us to have friends. He didn't want us to have a social life. We grew up Jehovah's Witnesses. So we had to, you know, go to the Kingdom Hall 3 times a week, Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. But it's like we're there and we're, like, learning about who Jehovah is and how we're supposed to live our life, righteous, you know, but he's living this whole different lifestyle. So I kind of feel like with this religion, it was just almost like a front to keep a front. Like, you know, we're so religious and we're so holy. But when we get home, it's a whole different story. And the thing is with my father, he was just too involved in me and my life, like too involved in my friends. If I would have, like, a boy call the house, he would have to screen the call and listen. He picked us up from school and dropped us off at school just so we didn't have any social life because he knew what he was doing to me, and it's almost as though he didn't want that to come out, so he had to control my every move and make sure that, you know, I was always at home. Because he didn't work. He didn't really have a real job, day-to-day job that he would go to as a man who's supposed to provide for his family. He was just spend most of his time home just basically just watching our every move. Like, that's the type of household we grew up in. It was just, you could never do no right. He just wanted to instill despair into you.
Who was the financial support of your family?
My mom was. My mother.
Okay.
She will work two jobs at a time. She always had more than one job. They had a couple of business ventures that they've done together, but he never had like a 9-to-5 job that he would have to wake up and go to on a day-to-day basis.
Well,
and I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
And I was saying that that was the big problem. That was a big problem because she knew that he has this problem. And I almost feel as though she kind of had kids for all the wrong reasons. It seems like she had kids just to kind of like feed him, like feed us to him, you know.
Man. Well,
I never understood her purpose as being a mother. It was nothing that she embraced.
Peter, and see what Peter has to say to you.
Sure.
Okay. Peter's from Ontario, Canada, so he might have a different accent than we do, okay?
Okay.
Hey, Peter, with the different accent.
G'day, Pamela, and good evening, everybody. G'day, Francine. I can vouch what you went through as far as all the abuse, verbal and physical, with the father. But when you're going to school, I mean, I missed the part. Did you say that you would beat down the teacher?
No, he slapped me in my face in front of one of my teachers in school.
Okay,
and
so didn't a teacher or anyone even saw what was going on or
didn't ask anything? It was almost, to me, the thing about it is in my culture, that's kind of normalized in the Jamaican culture, I guess. Because my father will often say that his father abused them. That's how he grew up. Like, they were beaten. But the teacher, she never asked me any questions about him. Like, you know, are you okay? I do know that when when he physically abused my brother and beat him in his joints with a wrench, I did reach out to a social worker at the school, and I did tell someone. And Dyfus did come to the house. And then they asked questions, they did an interview, and then they left. They, you know. And the thing about with that one, there's that guilt that played a role in it. You know, I'm trying to break the family up. Why did I say anything? You know, that was in my place. And then my father was just being... It's almost as though he was just, like, threatening me. Like, why did you do that? Like, what was the point? It was just a lot of guilt added after I did that. But that was one of the times I can definitely say that I did reach out to someone at the school. Because, like, the way he had beaten my brother that time, it was really bad. And I felt like I had to advocate for him.
Okay, Now, majority of this took place in Jamaica, right?
No, none of this took place in Jamaica. This was in Inglewood, New Jersey, where we grew up at.
Why wasn't law enforcement brought in? I mean, again, you know, we all know that, you know, like I'm also a survivor from sexual molestation from a child, but you know, when people have suspicion, they want to go to talk to somebody. I'm trying to be very careful how I word my questions because I don't want to offend anybody. So, what you know, like, was your father doing drugs or alcohol? Any other?
No, he did drink beer because when they, yeah, he was big on beer, but I wouldn't say he was like an alcoholic. I wouldn't say that. When the sexual abuse first happened, like when he first touched me, he did have a beer. That I do remember. But to say he was an alcoholic, no. He was not alcoholic.
Wow. That's all, pretty much all the questions I want to ask you for the moment, Francine. You're doing a very good job of sharing your story. And I'm grateful to actually be sitting here to listen to your story as well. So thank you, and keep up with the good work. You're doing a very brave job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, we're going to go down to Janice from California. Francine, Janice may have a comment or a question. Janice? You're on with.
I missed the very first few minutes. How did your father treat your mother?
He was abusive towards her too. I would say more abusive, emotional abuse, verbal abuse, verbally. Talked down to her, you know, called her out of her name. I remember there's times he tried to push her out of the car. Like I said, my mother has really, really low self-esteem, and it just seems as though there was nothing that he can do in order to walk away from him. But
and
I do remember, you know, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, the other question I have, but the previous caller just alluded to, is when you talk to someone at school, then how come Child Protective Services were not called?
I reached out to a social worker at the school. The one time that I can recall ever doing that was when my twin brother was badly physically abused with a wrench because it was bad.
Uh-huh.
So I remember reaching out to someone in school about that, and they did come to the house. And they, you know, they asked us questions, and they interviewed us, and that was it. They didn't do anything. And I remember right after that had happened, you know, there's that guilt that they put on me for trying to break the family up. And I'm not going to lie, I felt really, really bad, you know, as a child. I mean, I guess it was just normal for me to feel that way. But that's the only time I could ever recall calling DICEUS while I was in Englewood in that household. I was trying to advocate for my brother.
Okay. Okay, those are the two questions that I had, but for now.
Ms. Janice, thank you for calling in and being supportive of Francine.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Francine, you're telling your story wonderful. And, you know, just remember all of us here are survivors, okay? A lot of
yes.
our tales are similar, so we just want you to feel relaxed and calm and take a deep breath. But now we're going to go into, if you don't mind, pick it up when your dad started molesting you. So when it first started, you know, and how long it lasted.
So I'm not going to go into too much details with the sexual abuse.
Oh, no.
It lasted about 4 years. And it started, the way it started at first, like I said, he was drinking a beer, Heineken beer. And I remember sitting on the bed. This was in the bedroom on the fourth floor, because what I was trying to say before is that with the whole grooming process, it was almost as though the whole abuse was set up by both my parents, because my mom and dad had a room in the basement, right? And the first floor upstairs was there, the kitchen and the living room. My room was the only room on that floor, which was across from the dining room. And then my siblings' rooms were upstairs, and my grandparents were upstairs before they moved out. They had a room upstairs. So he had easy access to me. But I remember one time he came home stressed out, depressed, drinking a beer, and I was sitting in the bedroom on the first floor. And I remember I had like a fuchsia pink shirt on. It was a silk shirt. And he just started touching me, like, you know, on my breast, like he was caressing it. And it was just, I'm thinking to myself, like, you know, I know what's going on, but I'm like saying to myself, is this really happening? And the thing about it is my siblings, they were a lot younger, but they were there on the bed when he did that. And I think when he did that, he just was kind of testing the waters to see if I would tell, see how I would react, and see just to see what he can get away with. Something that he did that was also disturbing to me was, you know, I was a preteen going through puberty. And my mother never had to talk to me. She never had to talk, you know, like the safe touch, unsafe touch, or, you know, about my menstrual cycle, anything of that sort. But he did. And I remember he would, like, get a pen and paper, and he would draw it out on paper. Like, this is what this looks like. This is what that looks like. This is what the male, you know, private area looks like. And this is the hymen. I remember him drawing the hymen, telling me this is what the hymen is. So he was preparing me for the sexual abuse, you know. And it was around that same time when he even started buying me a lot of stuff. He was buying me stuff. Like, he always had something come home with something for me. The thing is, when my mom is home, when she would come home, he treated me like I was just the black sheep. It's like, you know, like I was, like, he wanted to instill, even though he was doing that to me, he wanted to still make sure he instilled that fear in me, you know.
Right.
But that's just a couple of the things that he did that was just inappropriate.
Definitely, for a man, for the dad to teach the young lady, that was definitely grooming and idiosyncratic,
yeah.
And yeah, inappropriate.
And some of the things that he would also say, some of the things that he also have said in the past was, like, he would say stuff like how he was not attracted to my mother, and how she was ugly, and how he wanted to run away with me, like, and never come back. So in his head, it's like, I'm the other woman. Like, he doesn't even view me as his daughter. Like, I'm this other woman to him.
That's sick, isn't it? That's sick thinking or sick dialogue with you. Yeah, my abuser, my stepdad, in a deposition when my case went to civil court, told them that he was having an affair with me at 4 years old. I mean, give me a break.
Wow. Yeah.
That is pretty sick. And we're going to go to Penelope, see if she has any comments or questions, okay? Yeah.
Oh, friend.
Penelope.
Thank you, Pamela. And Francine, it's just such a hard thing to talk about, right? It's so hard to talk about that. So first of all, again, I think it takes a lot of courage. And so I just want to acknowledge that.
And thank you.
So I was curious, you know, about why fathers molest their daughters. And I went on the internet a couple years ago trying to find this answer, right? Now I know...
Yeah.
A lot of children that are sexually abused are, you know, it's not limited to biological parents. It can be, you know, someone that they know, a relative, a step parent. But I was more just curious about why, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, men that molest, anybody that molests a child is a sick person. And I remember this article I found in the Oklahoman. I can say that, Oklahoman magazine. I could only find one source, and it said, and this is reminding me a little bit of the story that you're telling about your family of origin, that the mother, so in some cases, you know, the mother
is somehow emotionally unavailable to the father. Maybe she's got some mental illness, or she's just aloof. There's something they're missing in the relationship. And so then sometimes these men turn to their daughters to fulfill something in the marriage. And not that I'm not condoning it, but this is what I really found interesting. And they talked about the grooming, right? And you were talking about the grooming. That because these men start convincing themselves, and to Pamela's point, that their daughters then somehow become just another a female, right, companion, filling this void, like a female, they don't see them anymore as their daughters or their relations. And they sometimes are very unaware of the transition between it just like, right, it's almost like they just, you know, it, when it transitions into sexual abuse, it's almost like because of the grooming, it just is it evolves that they're not even fully aware. I mean, not condoning again, it's just this thing that just, it kind of evolves like it would evolve in any relationship. And that is, you know, how it happens. And that just kind of the way your father's, you know, buying you gifts and clearly from your mother, you know, you were the black sheep of me. And God, just so I'm thinking about this little girl who 11, 12 years old, just wanting to take you under my arms, under my wing and, you know, protect you. I'm just having strong feelings as I hear this story, but your mom just sounds like she reacted like she's got a competitor in the house. And so this article came to mind again because of just what I had read. Again, I'm not condoning it. For me, I was just curious I wanted answers, right? Sometimes we just want answers. And when you grasping for answers. And unfortunately, you know, and this is why I think NASCA's, you know, I love NASCA and everything that NASCA has to offer in terms of information and resources, is because out of all the searching I did, I found one article, right?
Yeah.
We need more. This is why I applaud you for talking about it. You know, every time we tell our story, you tell your story, you're bringing your voice to it, and people are listening, they're learning, they're paying attention. So, but that was more of a comment about what you had stated. And you know, your family is, it's just to Janice's question and just puzzled, you know, I'm bewildered, right? I'm perplexed but also it makes me angry because we have a situation with my husband's sister where the children were in a very abusive environment. CPS went out. Like, how bad does it have to get? I mean, they come out, they do the little report, and then they just close the file, right?
Yep.
It's just such an injustice. So I just, you know, I'm holding space for
you.
Thank you.
To your comments, Penelope, To your comments, Penelope, that those were perfect things to bring up because, you know, somebody out there, a mother might be listening and thinking, you know, why did this happen? How did this happen? And you've just given some reasons for it and, you know, given them some insight into how to protect their children more and how to talk to them and listen to them. But what do you do when a mother's complicit with it? You said your mother was complicit, Francine. In which way was she complicit? How do you know she was complicit?
Because the sexual abuse happened to one of my siblings already. And I don't want to go into too much details, but it's like clear as day that he's a pedophile. And he was he was a registered sex offender. I know for a while he didn't register until recently. But, I mean, what other signs do you need to know that this man has a problem? You work in night shifts. Like, she works nights and weekends. Like, when I say night, she's not home at night. So, and if he has this kind of access to me, remember, like, my room is the only room on that floor.
Right.
Like, this is like, carefully thought out. So she has to be complicit. Like,
yeah,
this is she's a big part of the problem.
She neglected
you. Did you go to her
neglect?
And actually?
That's
Did you go to your mother and actually confront your mother and tell her the truth?
My mother knew. I knew my mother knew. I didn't tell her anything, and I felt like the way I hated my father so badly in front of everybody when we had family come over at family gatherings, my hatred towards him was so strong that outsiders were speculating the abuse. I have an aunt who was my mother's best friend. It was my father's brother's wife. They were best friends, and they even had a falling out. And I remember seeing her recently in 2015. She ran to me, she hugged me, and she went into these stories about how she tried to protect me. She said, "I knew that your father was sexually abusing you." She said, "I knew because you hated him so much, and he have done it to your other sister." She knew this, and she told my mother, "You need to handle that." That's what she told her, and they had a falling out. Like they stopped. She said that was one of the main reasons why they had a falling out is because of that. She knew. She said every time I would come to the house for gatherings, you were locked up in your room. You were withdrawn. You didn't want to talk to anybody. And I obviously hated my father. Strong indicators. Like, if you have outsiders who can see this, how can you miss the signs? I just knew my mother knew. I just didn't know how to verbally express it to her, but I knew she knew.
Well, Francine, that's neglect. That is neglect, and it's as heinous a crime towards a child as anything else, as far as I'm concerned. Parents are supposed to protect their children no matter what. No matter what.
Right. Yep.
And your mom chose to be in whatever, and I've heard denials and addiction, whatever you want to call it. That's just, no excuses here. Parents need to be parents, and it's our job to protect our children no matter what. No matter how hard it is to admit what's going on, you just have to do it. Has to be done. This is black and white. Right?
Yeah.
We're having some background. Some background noise. Francine, are you on speakerphone?
It could be me. My kids are about to leave for soccer. I'm going to put it on mute.
I can't get on speakerphone, but I am on speaker.
Okay. Let's, if you can, go from when you left that place. I don't know if it was when you got out of high school. Did this go on till you got out of the house and did you go to college?
I just recently graduated from college, but we don't. I guess you don't want me to go that far into to go back.
No,
to
you can go. You can go far.
Yeah. So I recently graduated from college and my bachelor's. Not last month, in January, and that was a 12-year journey for me. And I struggled a lot with my academics in college because I was in an abusive relationship with my son's father. And I didn't have a strong support system. So when I started college, my son was just celebrating his first birthday, and I was also working a full-time job. My son's father was not really the provider. I was in a really, really toxic relationship with him and eventually found the strength to leave it in 2014. And I started my advocacy work in 2014, that same year, with child abuse prevention and child abuse prevention efforts. Yes, can you hear me?
Francine? When did you leave the home? What age did you leave from your abuse?
So I want to say 16. At about 16 going on 17.
Okay. And how were you able to support yourself?
I was living with
family. How were you?
Family at the time.
You went
before I was living with family, like family members.
Okay, but when did you leave the home and get out from away from your abuser?
So my mother moved to Florida, I want to say when I was 15 going on 16. She moved us to Florida, and I want to say I started the 9th or 10th grade when I was in Florida, but the abuse, the sexual abuse continued. And my mother, again, she was not present. She would still travel far to go to work and come back, I want to say probably about once a week. Like, we would see her once a week. But the abuse did start,
wow.
The abuse did continue in Florida. The thing is, when I was in Florida, I told a friend of mine, this is how everything came out. I had a best friend in Florida that I confided in, and I told her, I don't know if I confided in her or if I may have said something that was off and unusual, but all I know is that she probably caught up in what I said and probably thought to herself, well, that's not normal. And she went behind my back and told a counselor about what was happening at home. And then my counselor pulled me in, questioned me, and told me that, you know, unfortunately, because I'm a mandated reporter, I have to report this. And so I remember her calling in my mom. She told me the exact day my mom was going to, she called my mom in. I didn't even have the conversation with my mother because I knew that she would call my mom. But she called my mom, called her into school, and then they pulled me out of class for me to tell my mom in her face what's been going on in front of the counselor. And all I can remember is crying. Like, I was barely able to get my words because I was crying so much. And my mom, my mother, she called me a liar right then and there. She said she's making all this up because she doesn't want to move. Because we were planning to move again. Like, it seems like when school or, like, anyone would kind of get, like, wind of what's going on at home, she's quick to move. But she told the counselor that I was upset because we were going to move and I didn't want to be away from my friends, which was, it was a lie. And the counselor told her, I don't understand how you can sit here in front of your daughter who's crying her eyes out, her pouring her heart out. How you can sit here and call her a liar? Like, my mom had a straight face. So that happened. And so I eventually did tell my mom, like, verbally, like, even though I felt like she already knew, it's like, okay, what are you going to do about it now? But what happened was, my mom ended up selling the house that she had bought in Florida. And we moved into a small apartment. And I guess they separated for like a small period of time. But when I say separated, I mean it's him not just, he didn't want to be around me. Him and my mom still had their relationship or whatever they had going on. They just didn't want to include me in it. Because they
were
knew
the
that
police
at the time
here?
That I was going to. Yeah, I did call the police again because he kept coming around. I remember calling the police again because we moved into a smaller apartment. It was temporary until we were moved to Maryland because she wanted to move to Maryland with her sister, to stay with her sister. And I remember calling the police and the police coming by. And I told the police that, you know, briefly what had happened in school and how he's not supposed to be around me. And he keeps coming to this place, the apartment that we were at the time. And the police questioned everybody. And I remember the police clearly telling my mom that if she called the police again because he's coming, because he's back here and she feels unsafe, obviously, then we're going to have to take matters in our own hands. So he was just basically giving my mom a warning. Of course, at that time, my father was nowhere to be found. But she sold the house, and she got so much money for the house, and she bought him a car, and they were just spending all of this money. I was home by myself, basically, you know, treated like the black sheep. They didn't want me to get involved or know anything. So now, because I spoke my truth, it's like they're treating me like this, you know, like the rotten child. Like, you know, she's just trying to break up the family, and we don't want to have nothing to do with her. So you can only imagine how that was for me.
Right.
But then we eventually moved to Maryland. My mom wanted to stay with her sister in Maryland temporarily. My dad wasn't with us. I guess he moved back to New Jersey at the time. But he did come out. He did come around again. And this particular sister of my mom, I told her, I remember telling her, you know, he's not supposed to be around us. Like, why is he around? So obviously he was giving her money. I guess that was just his way of, like, having his way with her. And I remember telling her that if he comes back around here, I'm going to call my sister, my bigger sister, who's like my mother. She was still, at the time, she was in law school in Lansing, Michigan. And I remember my aunt, you know, telling me, like, if you get disrespectful with me again, you know, it's going to be a problem. I'm not getting disrespectful with you. I'm just letting you know that he's not supposed to be around me or anywhere around the home. And we got into it. She told me to call my sister. And I said, sure, I'll call my sister. Like, my sister's going to agree with me. I called my sister. My sister didn't pick up the phone. So I hung up the phone. And all I know, that particular aunt basically grabbed me. And I can't tell you exactly what happened. I don't know. It was just like we were, like, almost fighting. It's like she was just, like, she grabbed me, kind of yoked me up on the bed and was just, like, kind of, you know, shaking me. And my little sister was in the room, and she started screaming. And, you know, of course, I cried, and I cried myself to sleep that night. The following morning, I woke up with a black eye. Didn't even know I had a black eye. All I know that all this commotion is happening, she put her hand on me. And the following morning, I had a black eye. So this is in Baltimore, Maryland. This is how I ended up in Maryland. I remember going to the school, and one of my friends at the school noticed a black eye and said that, you know, you have to tell a counselor. So we both went to the counselor and told the counselor. The counselor told, she asked me, is there anyone that you feel safe with that you can stay with temporarily while we look into this and investigate this? And I said, the only person that I can trust is my big sister. But my sister was all the way in Michigan at the time. So she called my sister. And my sister was so heated about it. And she immediately, you know, purchased me a Greyhound ticket and told me, you know, just come stay with me for now. Forget about school. You need to be safe. And so I remember traveling to my friend and her mom both took me to the train station, well, the bus station, put me on the bus, gave me some money, and I got to Lansing, Michigan the following morning, early in the morning, to stay with my sister. And my sister, you know, she's in law school. She's struggling, because she's in law school, and she was just doing the best to kind of help get me situated. She was even going as far as trying to get me emancipated. But because I was, like, 17 at the time, they were like, it doesn't make sense you go through that process of being emancipated, because you're going to be 18 soon. By the time that process is even over, you'll probably be 18 by then. But I never went back to that particular aunt's house. I ended up with that aunt's daughter who lives in Hyattsville. It's a long story. She said that
Can we stop again right here? And we'll just kind of do a little recap. So you end up, you end up with your mom and your dad's in and out of your life, and you're scared of him. You try to get the police involved. Why was he never arrested once you, the counselor, and you and your mom faced the counselor and told the truth? Why was he not arrested at that time?
To be quite honest, that's a good question. I don't know. And I really believe it's because my mother was like, it's rare, it's very, very rare that a mother is advocating for the father in this situation. So it's almost as though it was like probably easier for them to believe that, well, she's probably just a disturbed problem child, because that's how she would describe me. Like, oh, she's just lying, she's this and she's that, you know. But
I understand.
Yeah.
My mother was that way.
Now, had my mother
she
been
was always,
supportive of me.
Always on the other person's side. She was always on
somebody
else's side. Yeah, and that just shows, you know, that she was, she hated us children. She did. She didn't want us.
Yeah.
She never wanted us.
Yeah.
And she was in competition with us. And she blamed us for everything that happened wrong in her life.
So
we've gone through all of that, and now we're getting to when you are starting into your adulthood and into your college. But let's go back to the panel real quick and just see what Penelope has to say. Yeah, Penelope.
Thank you, Pamela. And Francine, I guess I can say that your sister, thank God for your sister and also for the counselor and also for your friend and her mother.
Yeah.
You know, who were there to you had some support, but, you know, your sister, I mean, she reacted the way a mother should react, right?
Exactly, yes.
And, you know, the more of the story that I hear and of your mother's behavior, you know, have a similar situation going on in our own family where it's hard for me to understand how a mother, you know, can reject her own child, you know, not ever have wanted them. And I looked at the term malignant narcissist. I don't know if people have looked at that term. I never knew that term existed. I think I heard it on another show or on the NASCA web space or page maybe. Because it's still, you know, the suffering of a child to have a mentally ill mother or, a mother that's a malignant narcissist. I mean, it's, the things that you went through are just, no child should ever have to bear everything that you've endured. In terms of your sister, I guess I can just say she's amazing too. I mean, she obviously is, was in law school and still, and when you said the comment, she told you just school can wait. Your safety is more important. That really struck me. I thought, exactly. I mean, that is the way that everyone should think, right, when it comes to how to protect our children. I don't really have any questions for you because you're doing such a great job, but yeah.
Yeah, she is. She's filling in all the blanks. What we like to do is make sure that the audience is not confused and understands, your feelings and your pain, and, they can feel not alone. A lot of us out there feel alone that this never happened to anybody but us, thank you. I'm going to Peter on with Francine. Peter, you're on with Francine.
G'day, Francine. It's Peter here from Ontario.
Hey, Peter.
There's a few questions and there's some comments that I, thanks for bringing that comment that you made, Penelope. I quite agree about a mother or even parents supposed to nurture their children. I'm not too sure if this question has been asked to you. Who was the favorite? For example, my sister was, it was mummy's little girl, daddy's little girl. Was there a particular favorite that was in your family to attack you?
Yes, and that was the second younger sister, not the baby, but the second younger one. Still till this day, she's, supported by both parents. She's definitely her mother's child because she temporarily lost custody of her son for some years because me and my older sister were trying to get custody of our little sister, our baby sister. Because my baby sister had reached out to me and told me that my father tried to kiss her, and she texted to me. And, my sister, with her working in the law field, she went and got, an investigator or detective to kind of look into it some more, and they asked me to travel to New Jersey with the cell phone so that they can use it as some type of evidence. They were even thinking to have me call my father and, try to get him to admit what he did. but then they went a different route. They wanted me to go to court and basically, you know, share my truth just to get custody of my accountable with just what my sister did, with not with what the kiss that he, you know, they didn't feel like it was going to be something that they can just put him in jail for. So they were like, are you willing to, like, testify in court against him? And I'm like, sure. And that in itself, I remember clearly going to the courthouse and they questioned me, and that the detective would, like, pull me out at times and tell me that, you know, she said, do you know that that's considered rape? That's considered this, that, and third. And I'm like, I didn't know. Like, it's so normalized to think some of the things that I've had to do or some of the abuse that I went through, I didn't even look at it as that to that extent. But to make a long story short, what had happened was we were in New York. Me and my sister and my cousins were in New York, and we went to the house that my mom was staying at because my sister wanted to get her things. The thing is, in the state of New Jersey, they're like, well, you can't just take her. Even though you're trying to protect your little sister, that will be considered kidnapping. You will have to go to the police station and file a report and let them know that she feels unsafe. So me, my sister, and my cousins, we went to the police station, and I believe it's in Fairview, and we tried to file a report. And the thing that came up is they said, well, he's not a registered sex offender. And we're like, well, he should be. But anyway, that just opened up a whole can of worms, because then the social workers got involved and they looked into it, and they're like, well, he said he's supposed to be registered and he's not, and that's a problem. So I remember the social worker took my baby sister to the house that they were staying at, because she's like, you're not going to go back home. You're going to get your stuff. And we were kind of like outside of the house, just kind of like, well, me and my sister were at the station. My cousins were kind of like staking out around the house just to see if he would open the door or to see if his van was there. His van was definitely there. So they're communicating with us while we're in the police station, telling us what's happening. And so the social worker knocked the door with my baby sister, trying to get someone to open it, see if anyone's going to open it. No one opened the door. So she basically, I don't know if she kicked the door open or what she did, but she was able to get in. And I guess she may have heard something move or like somebody's trying to hide. And she's like, you know, hello, hello, hello. And of course she had a police there to accompany her. She's like, hello. And then she told my sister to grab her stuff. All she knows is that when she went to the kitchen, she heard a movement. So she went to the kitchen and opened the cupboard. And my father was hiding there with my nephew, which is my second younger sister's son. They didn't only take my sister away with her stuff. They took the nephew because he shouldn't be home with any child because he was supposed to be a registered sex offender. Then they take my nephew and my sister to back to the police station. They call my sister, who's the mother. Yes.
Francine? Excuse me. Yeah, the story's getting kind of long, and I have to go to the next panelist. So,
got it.
Thank you, Peter, for your question. Okay, let's go to Janice in California. Janice, you're on with Francine. That was a great story, Francine.
I really don't have a question. Good. I don't really have a question right now.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. So let's get back to your story, Francine. And what I'm looking at your bio, and what I'm seeing here is that you had some unresolved trauma and toxic stress. It manifested in OCD, and you still struggle with that. But you started on your healing journey in October 2020. That's pretty recent.
That's pretty recent.
And you're seeing a trauma-informed therapist twice a week. And let's see. So I'm really happy to hear about your current healing journey. Do you mind taking us on that a little bit?
Sure.
We're down to about
almost 20 minutes left in the show, so we're going to give you about 10 minutes to talk about the healing journey you're on, and then 10 minutes to talk about your advocacy. So take about 10 minutes or so and talk about your therapy and your healing journey now.
Sure. So I've decided to take this. So as I mentioned before, the advocacy work started in 2014, which I find to be very therapeutic, you know, advocating on behalf of children of abuse. But I never really started my healing journey. And I feel like I should have at least started that after I got out of the abusive relationship with my son's father. But last year, I took this mental health coaching and advocacy course because I'm like, well, I'm advocating for children, but the aftermath of that is usually, you know, as adult survivors of abuse, we struggle with our mental health. So I felt like that would have been a good component to my advocacy, is learning more about how to help those who struggle with their mental health, you know, find the tools and resources to start their healing journey. But after I completed the course, I'm like, well, how am I going to coach and help others, particularly survivors of abuse, with this process if I have never gone through the process myself? So I decided to use the tools and resources. Yep, I decided.
Exactly.
I saw it as a sign from God to say, well, now you have the tools, use it. Why not? So I used the tools, and to be quite honest, I didn't know where to begin. You know, I know I can probably, like, do my insurance, get a therapist, but I wanted somebody who was more, like, trauma-informed and who specializes in OCD. So I used those tools, and I did reach out to a therapist late October of last year. When a therapist called me, she did intake. She told me that, you know, you are considered a crisis client. And I'm like, oh, wow, I didn't know. She said, I need to see you twice a week. Like, you need to unpack a lot of things. You're not only are you struggling with your OCD, but we need to, like, help you resolve the trauma that you've never even addressed at all. So I've been seeing her twice a week since then. And I've learned a lot about, you know, myself that I didn't know. She says, you've been living your whole life in survival mode. You're not living your life. You're surviving. Like, you need to train your body, your nervous system, your brain to get out of that mode and start to enjoy life, because you're so used to going through this, you know, surviving, and you're moving, and you're not really showing up for yourself. And it was deep. I was like, oh, wow, like, I would have never thought that, you know, but I must say that there's been a lot of progress with the with my healing journey. We've been working from, like, there's like an OCD workbook that we use. I'm doing exposure therapy, CBT, and another one that's called ACT, acceptance therapy, which has been very effective, especially the exposure piece. I must say that I had to be consistent with it in order to get better. But I'm definitely, you know, there's been progress with that. But she just was able to identify a lot of things. One of the things that she said that resonated with me is that you are a walking miracle. And it was nice hearing that from someone other than, you know, a family member or someone that I'm close to, but just for her to not really know me and just hear my story and my truth and say, so the fact that you've made it this far and you're doing the things that you're doing, it's just, you know, it amazes me. And it's an ongoing process. The healing journey is definitely going to be a long journey for me. It's an ongoing process because I still have a lot to unload and process. And for the first time, I was able to really actually process what I experienced. I've been avoiding it my whole life, the feelings, like the discomfort, like, the feelings of being neglected, not being supported. It's like I kind of put that on the back burner and just was just kind of winging life, but I never processed any of it. And so
right.
As I started to process it,
so,
it's like, wow, it's,
so,
you know, this is
yeah.
what I should have gone through as a child.
Right.
Because it's,
but
I,
everything
I, happens. It is.
Yep. But everything happens in the right time. It sounds like to me you stepped on your healing journey just right, and it sounds like you're
yes.
your the path is speeding up like a treadmill. It sounds like you're on a fast track, and you're kind of young still. You sound very young. I don't know how old you are, but
I'm
the younger. Awesome. See, I'm 63, and I didn't start working on my process till 50s. So I'm really glad and really happy for the trend that's happening for younger people to start wanting to get on their healing path at a younger age. We need that so bad, and I'm so proud of you for stepping out
Thank
early in life and not running from the pain and facing the pain. You know, it's like not wanting to go to the dentist and putting it off and putting it off. Why? Because the dentist is going to, it may be painful, right,
yeah.
to go to the dentist. But we have to go because that's our health, right? I mean, our teeth are a gateway to our health. And so we have to keep
yeah.
them, you know, good and healthy. It's the same thing with our mental health, especially with our mental health, because they go hand in glove. So I am so proud of you. Now, you said what helped you heal a lot was your writing, that you do poetry.
Yes.
So have you always been a writer?
Yes, I've been writing since I was about 10, 12, around that time. That was like my safest way to express myself, and it was just an outlet for me because all of the things that I was suppressing as a child, so I just wrote. I couldn't talk about it, so I just wrote it. And in 2017, when I turned 30, I finally decided to publish my book. It's called Break the Silence and Bloom, My Poetic Testimony. And with that
slow
book,
down and say,
you know, I hope.
Slow down and say your name again. Yeah,
it's
say
called
the name
Break
again.
Yes, Break the Silence and Bloom. Break the Silence and Bloom, My Poetic Testimony.
Ooh, that sounds so good. Break the Silence and Bloom. What do you think, Penelope? Penelope, what do you think about that title? Break the Silence.
I think it's beautiful. I think it's beautiful because it's so true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
And
she
published it in 2017, and it has 30 poems, and she
yes,
says breaking your silence.
Amazon.
Okay, it's available on Amazon, and
yes.
is there any place else people can get it, like Barnes and Nobles or on the website
yes.
or anything? Just Amazon.
Yes.
Okay.
It's available on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we just thank you, don't we, Penelope, about how much she shared and how well she's doing. And I'm so happy you have a trauma-informed therapist. I mean, you know, a lot of people can heal without therapy. I'm not saying you have to have a therapist. But
yeah.
a trauma-informed therapist these days are very trained in child sexual abuse or child abuse. And I think
yes.
it really people on a fast track to learning, to healing. You know, it's like, I think you can get there faster. But people take the way they want to heal, you know. Everybody has the right
yeah.
to heal the way, in their own timing and the way they want to heal. So we're not putting
exactly.
anybody in a box, right? But you really endured a lot, okay? And even being your biological father, I could never understand that. I mean, mine was done by a stepdad, and I just don't understand how a person can have a child and do that to them, you know.
Yeah.
But to me, somewhere in their background and in your mother's background, they must have had something happen to them, you know, painful.
Yeah.
And, you know, the saying, hurting people hurt people, right? So.
Yep. Absolutely.
But you're breaking
the
cycle, and we're very proud of you. You broke the cycle. You broke it. And I'm very proud of you
Thank
for doing that.
Thank
so
you.
So have you found a relationship now that you're in, or you're
yes,
not in reality?
I'm currently married. I'm married with two kids. My son, he's 13. His name is Giovanni. And my daughter, she's 4. Her name is Fatima. So I'm married with two kids. Happily married.
Does your husband support your journey?
Oh, yes. he does. We talk about, you know, he till this day he's like, I just don't understand how a father can do that. He's very, very supportive. Very.
That's awesome. Well, we're going to go back to the panel and let them say goodnight and talk to you
okay.
one more time. So, Peter, you're on with Francine.
Oh, g'day, Francine. It's Peter from Ontario again. I do wish you all the best on your journey, on the recovery of your journey. You know, I'm going to say that, you know, we're all survivors, and I've also learned that there's ways of thriving and there's always ways of surviving, and you've been through it all. Penelope, Pamela, I have,
yes.
My wife, Michelle, you know, we've been through all this, a journey that it's not going to end until the day that we die. And all I can
yep.
say is I congratulate you and I wish you all the best. And my prayers, you're in my prayers. So.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Hello?
Yeah, Pamela, you might be on mute, maybe.
Playing before we go?
Yeah, I wish you continued success on your journey and continued success in selling a lot of your books. And,
thank you, I appreciate it.
I'd be very proud of what you've accomplished so far, and I was happy to know that you're in a very secure and happy relationship with your husband and your children. So best of luck.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So sweet, Miss Janice. Penelope, you want to say something as we go out?
Yeah, I do. Thank you. And Francine, first of all, I just want to thank you for bringing up the fact that you went through trauma-informed therapy, because you know, people that are listening into your show that may be at the very beginning of their healing journey, you know, and not
yes.
knowing where to go, where to start. Thank you for bringing that up. I think when you've had a complex trauma, when you've had a trauma like child abuse,
yes.
we don't know what we don't know, right? You didn't know that you were in a state of fight or flight your whole life. That was your normal,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
So we don't know. So thank you so much for bringing that up. Because when you're in the fight or flight mode as a child and you carry that with you as an adult, we talked about mental health, and Pamela alluded to physical health, but they also intersect with each other because the burdens that
yes.
we're carrying become so heavy, and we have physical manifestations of our trauma. So, and that's also
yes.
addressed, right, in the trauma-informed therapy.
Yes.
So thank you. I just want to thank you for bringing that up, and I'm so happy that you found that that worked for you and that has helped you really propel you into your healing journey. So I wanted to acknowledge that, and then I wanted to say, you know, regarding you and your older sister and what you've done to advocate for your siblings. But to Pamela's point, you know, we will never know the whole story of our parents and you know, what happened, right, in terms
yeah.
of their abuse and why they were the way that they were. But you can
yeah.
say that you know that the cycle of abuse went on for some time. You have,
yeah.
you and your sister and your siblings, if they've been involved, you know, it sounds like you and your sister are more spearheading it, you're stopping the cycle. So that tree,
yeah.
that family tree, and a little bit of a pun to your book, you have a new branch that's blooming in a completely different direction, and that's thanks to you. And so that tree is going to look a lot different now. And the history, you know, you're going to rewrite history by changing that pattern. So I just think you're amazing, and I keep up the good work, and I actually sent you a friend request on Facebook. You don't have to accept
it. I accepted it.
Okay, thank you. But it looks like you have such a loving husband and your children are adorable, and so it just warms my heart
thank
to see
you.
That, you know, your life is a good, you know, you're happy, and you're raising your children the way that you wanted to be raised when you're nurtured. So good for you, and so it's such a privilege to be on the show tonight with you. So thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Penelope. I just wanted to say to you, Miss Francine, keep in touch with us. You're now considered a NASCA panel member, and we'd like for you to call in and be part of the panel when we have other special guests, all right, when you can.
I'd definitely love.
You call, call into the same number, and always at 8 p.m. Eastern, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We do have recovery groups. If you'd like to become part of the recovery groups on Tuesday and Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern, you can look at that. And tomorrow night, we're going to have Michelle Bless on. And Friday night, we're going to have another special guest on. So it's been really good having you on the show. And we're going to say good night. And thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the support.
You're so welcome. So everybody, have a good say good night to Francine and wish her well.
Good night, Francine.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, Francine.
Good night.
We wish you
well. Stay safe. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Thanks, Pamela. Thanks, Peter, and
thank you,
Jenna.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. God bless NASCA. God bless the children of the world.
I'll know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was gone. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.